Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the press briefing. At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity for questions, and instructions will be given at that time. If you need assistance during the call, please press star, then zero. I'll turn the call over now to our moderator, Ellen Wilson. Please go ahead.
Welcome to today's press briefing. I'm Ellen Wilson from Burnell Communications, serving as moderator. This press briefing will announce recommendations to policymakers on how to achieve food security in the face of climate change from the Commission on Sustainable Agriculture and Climate Change. I want to cover four logistical matters before we start. First, the embargo on the recommendations has now been lifted. Second, there is an online press kit where you will find the summary for policymaker document, press releases in English, Spanish, French, and coming soon, Chinese, and photos. A link to the digital recording of this audio briefing will also be available within 2 hours. The URL is http://cc=cat=frank=sam.cgiar.org/commission/press-room. Third, the five speakers will present remarks for the first 30 minutes of this briefing, after which time a question and answer session will begin. Please be sure to limit all questions to the recommendations presented on this call. Our speakers today are dialing in from different locations around the world, and the commissioners on the call will be introduced by Dr. Bruce Campbell, who is director of the CGIAR Research Program on Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security, also known by the acronym of CCAF. CCAF convened the independent commission that you're hearing from today. And now I'd like to present Dr. Bruce Campbell. Please go ahead, Dr. Campbell.
Good morning, everyone. A very early morning from Cali in Colombia. The threats and challenges from climate change and unsustainable use of resources are relevant for every country around the world. Food insecurity equates to human suffering, degradation of natural resources, poverty, migration, and political and economic instability. Climate change is on track to intensify these problems. Sustainable agriculture is a critical part of the response to these kinds of problems. The Commission was set up to produce evidence-based policy recommendations to respond to the challenges and problems I briefly mentioned. The Commission was established by the CGIAR Program on Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security. And to do this, we got support from the coalition of donors under the organization, the Global Donor Platform for Rural Development. The commissioners were appointed in their personal capacity and began work in early 2001. There are 13 commissioners, and they represent a diversity of disciplines. They cover natural and social sciences. They work in diverse fields, agriculture, climate change, food and nutrition, economics, natural resources. They come from diverse organizations, government, academia, civil society, and they include developing and developed countries from all the continents. So how did they do their work? An essential part was a synthesis of the major assessment reports that are out there. And they use these to articulate the scientific findings on the impacts of climate change on agriculture and food security, and they thereby identified the appropriate pathways and actions to achieve food security in the context of climate change. We are fortunate to have four of the 13 commissioners with us today. The Commission Chair, Professor Sir John Beddington, is dialing in from London. Dr. Adrian Fernandez is dialing in from Mexico City. Dr. Megan Clark from Australia, and Professor Judy Wahongo from Nairobi. The Commission full report will be released in early 2012. This is the summary for policymakers that is being released today. I think it's highly relevant to the upcoming UN climate change talks in Durban, and I look forward to the discussion this morning. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Our next speaker is Sir John Beddington. Please go ahead, Sir John.
Thank you very much. And well, it's a curious greeting to everyone. So it's good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and good night, given the locations around the world. Just a very short correction to Bruce's remarks before I start properly, which is we actually did start our work not in 2001, but in 2011. So this has not been a 10-year project. It may have felt like that on occasion. So let me get into it. Bruce has covered some of these things, but we've got, in the 21st century as we are now, we've got a major set of converging threats. There's population growth, unsustainable resource use, big problems about pressures on humanity to transform the way that we actually use food, but actually also intimately linked with water issues, with energy issues, and of course, with the major issue of climate change. The current situation is just unacceptable. A large portion of the human population is food insecure or vulnerable to food insecurity. 1 billion people or so go hungry, and that is genuine poverty, and on something of the order of another 1 billion people don't have appropriate nutrition. It's seen, and it's arguably ironic, that at the same time there's about 1 billion people or so who are suffering from chronic disease due to overconsumption. We're sitting that in a context of a world population, currently 7 billion, but scheduled to grow to something around 9 billion by 2050. And we are seeing changes in consumption patterns as, and this is a good thing, significant parts of the world population are improving because they are actually getting somewhat wealthier. But that leads to a shift in demand for food, for fodder for animals, and for bioenergy crops. And I think the diet shifting towards a higher consumption of calories, fats, and animal products presents in its own problems. We've seen in the last 2 or 3 years significant price spikes following on decades of declining in real food prices, and those spikes have really presented real problems of exacerbating poverty. Something of the order of 100 million people went into poverty following the 2007-08 price spike. Another 40 or so million went into poverty after the 2010-11 price spike. So this is a significant problem we need to address. At the moment, we're looking at an agriculture which doesn't meet its full yield potential, but has also got lots of negative environmental consequences, which include, of course, issues to do with land degradation, pollution, and so on, but also significant emissions of greenhouse gases. That's in a context, and some of this material is really well known, and then indeed the Commission synthesized many reports which made similar points, but something of a third of post-harvested food is lost or wasted by processors, distributors, and households. There's other issues, refrigeration and other supply chain activities actually do produce more greenhouse gases, and we need to be thinking about how we can actually address this problem. We know the climate is changing. The basic delays in the climate system mean that the greenhouse gases already in our atmosphere will drive climate change for the next 2 or 3 decades. We're going to see, and this all models and indeed all analyses indicate that there's already a trend that we're going to see more extreme events, high temperatures, droughts, floods, and actually these are already becoming more frequent. Analysis shows this. And we can expect these more severe events leading to really difficult social, economic, and ecological consequences. It's highly unlikely that these higher average global temperatures, or indeed higher temperatures across the world, are likely without dramatic changes in greenhouse gas emissions. We're going to see this unless we change. And we need to be thinking about how climate change will have an adverse overall effect on agricultural production itself, quite clearly, and many people have looked at these issues, and many of the reports that the Commission reviewed have covered these in a great deal of detail. So we need to think about the way in which we're going to move and address the twofold problems of food insecurity and poverty. So the summary for policymakers, which has been circulated, is initially a document which is a precursor of the main of the full document, which will be published early next year, and others will explain more detail. The Commission made 7 high-level recommendations. I'll just give you the headlines. These include integrate food security and sustainable agriculture into global and national policies, and I emphasize both global and national. Significantly raise the level of global investment in agriculture and food systems in the next decade. Sustainably intensify agricultural production while reducing greenhouse gas emissions and other obviously negative environmental consequences like pollution and so on. Target those populations and sectors that are most vulnerable to the mixed threats of climate change and food insecurity. Think hard and reshape food access and consumption patterns to ensure basic nutritional needs are met and to try and foster, on the obvious idea, healthy and sustainable eating habits. Waste, I've already alluded to, but reduce loss and waste in food systems, particularly where that waste is attributable to poor infrastructure, farming practices, and processing distribution and actual household habits. And finally, the 7th one I think is as important as any, though they are all, I believe, extremely important, is we don't have good information about what is happening in the world. We need to create a comprehensive, shared, integrated information system that involves not just, as it were, the ecology and the agricultural productivity, but also has information about humanity and the social conditions. Business as usual is not going to work. We are already seeing tragedies. We need to be thinking about how we can actually improve things. But it has to be a socially equitable approach. We need to be thinking about how to produce better funding, policy, management, and regional initiatives, because I emphasize global and national, but also regional initiatives are equally important. And we need to deliver nutrition, income, and climate benefits for all. Dr. Campbell mentioned that the Commission's recommendations are anchored in 13 individual members from around the world. And so I'm now going to hand back to my colleagues to talk in a bit more detail about some of these recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you, Sir John. Our next speaker is Dr. Adrian Fernandez. Please go ahead, Dr. Fernandez.
Thank you. Good morning. And let me elaborate a little bit more on one of the general recommendations that we just heard from Sir John. I'm talking about the second general recommendation, which is to significantly raise the level of global investment in sustainable agriculture and food systems in the next decade. Well, first of all, this is one of the big topics that will be discussed in Durban, financing. How can we mobilize much more resources to address the problems of climate change, in this case, related to such an important issue, which is food security and agriculture production? Humanitarian, environmental, and global security concerns certainly demand a global commitment to improve the situation of the large proportion of the human population, and this is because food insecure are vulnerable to food insecurity, and guess what? Because of climate change, achievement of maintenance of food security around the world is just going to be tougher and tougher. So the agriculture sector is, I'm sure, one of the sectors that will be perhaps more affected by climate impacts, and that's why the work of the Commission is so important. So really, countries need to know what the future holds for the food and climate system so that they can build some capacity, well, first of all, to measure and assess and to model the impacts of climate change on agricultural systems so that they can start building the so-called resilience to the climate shocks, to try to go through a new path of adaptation to these kind of new impacts of climate change. So we need a lot of information. We also need to make sure that we boost the productive assets in subsistence agricultural systems and improving support in infrastructure. We need to close the yield gaps and reducing food losses and waste. We need also to think about long-term sustainable economics associated to agriculture. We do know that climate threats to agricultural systems and food supply change are likely to be especially variable. In other words, when we talk about climate impacts, we know that each region, almost each country around the world, will suffer or is already suffering in a very different way. So by nature, talking about adaptation to climate change and adaptation in the agricultural sector means that we need specific information, a country-specific information, and we need to build capacity to do that. So the typical one-size-fits-all solutions doesn't work here. Even the approach that typically we take for mitigation, reducing emissions, doesn't work here. Here we need to know local conditions, local necessities in specific countries. Financing is so important. So global donors can help to promote better climate change risk management through a more coordinated, multi-benefit approach. The more institutions, foundations, countries get aware about the climate change impacts, the more we will see more resources flowing, perhaps, but also that will demand more and more coordination. One of the big priorities for action that is suggested by our commission is precisely better financing coordination. It is very important also that countries around the world make sure that they do the right delivery on existing the GA L'Aquila programs, in particular the financing commitments. So we heard not just in L'Aquila, but also in the last couple of COPs, the Conference of the Parties in Climate Change Negotiations, that there is already important resources flowing. People talk about $30 billion that they are being promised and are being delivered as we speak for the period 2010-2012, and it's quite likely that that fast start financing will be expanded into the next years, and the goal is to reach the level of $100 billion flowing in various types of support to address mitigation, but especially adaptation to climate change. And agriculture, as I already said, is one of the most important sectors. So a lot of new and additional resources will have to be available to countries to address the very serious challenges of food security and the impacts of climate change on agriculture. So national governments also should adjust national research and development budgets and build an integrated scientific capacity to reflect the significance of sustainable agriculture for economic growth, poverty reduction, and long-term environmental sustainability, and focus on key food security issues. For example, developing nutritious non-grain crops, reducing post-harvest losses, and so on. So this is a very complex challenge, and I think that many of the readers and countries around the world will find, hopefully, very useful some of the findings of the Commission. So in summary, investment, I would say technology and innovation, are required to adapt to climate change and to ensure food security while minimizing greenhouse gases emissions and sustaining our natural resource base. So now let me turn to my colleague, Dr. Megan Clark, to share some more with you on a related topic.
Thank you, Dr. Fernandez. Our next speaker is Dr. Megan Clark. Please go ahead, Dr. Clark.
Thank you very much, Vanessa, and welcome everyone to the call. Let me talk in more detail about the Commission's third recommendation, which is to intensify agricultural production while at the same time reducing greenhouse gas emissions and some of the other negative effects that John outlined. The challenge that's ahead of us globally is really quite hard even to comprehend. Because we must increase global food production by 2050 by some 30-80% and reduce our emissions by half. So sort of put another way, you know, as my children grow old over the next sort of 60 years, we'll need to produce as much food as has ever been produced in human history. And at the same time, during that period, we'll have to learn how to halve our emission rate from agriculture. So this is a huge challenge. In Australia, in my region, some 25% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from agricultural sector, and we see a figure that's very similar for the global average. But if we look at the amount of food we have to produce, we know that in many regions there are large gaps between what's being produced now and what could be produced. So, for example, in much of sub-Saharan Africa, we know that we could use very small doses of fertilizer at the base of individual plants and improve productivity, and we could also reduce the amount of fertilizer used. Similarly, we know in China that there's evidence that the current levels of high rates of fertilizers use can be reduced, and we can reduce nitrous oxide emissions and maintain our productivity. And we're now even seeing the opportunity in Bangladesh in some of the rice fields, where right now some of the land is left to fallow during the dry Rabi season. And our researchers and farmers are looking at ways of introducing crops such as wheat and maize during that dry season. But it's not just about increasing the production. And many of our agricultural systems around the world deplete the soil fertility, biodiversity, and water resources, and these things degrade the land. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude of that, an estimated 12 million hectares of agricultural land is degraded every single year. That land would have the potential to produce some 20 million tons of grain. And we add that each year to the 1.5 billion hectares that have already been degraded. So we must look at ways of restoring this degraded land at the same time as storing carbon, using things like sequestering the carbon through soils, looking at forest and environmental plantings. And this restoration of the land can help store carbon and stabilize and improve our food production. And of course, as our previous speakers have outlined, we must adapt, and not just adapt to the variations of climate that we're seeing today, but as Sir John outlined, being able to respond to the changes that will come in the future. We are seeing some exciting results in our region in India, for example. My own organisation, CSIRO, working with some of our partners, and we're providing farmers for the first time with seasonal climate forecasts. And these are being taken up by sort of farmer climate clubs. And the result is reducing crop failure in the early drought seasons. And in Cambodia, Cambodia is trialling rice varieties that have very short growing seasons, and that's helping farmers escape some of the mid-season droughts and even allowing them to do two rice crops. And, of course, in Australia, we're producing drought-tolerant wheat, sorghum and sugar in the Pacific Islands, drought-tolerant root crops. So this work, of course, can be scaled and globally, and these are the things we need to think about. So if we come back to the policy summary that's released today, the Commission in this specific third recommendation has identified several areas that attention is needed. Developing these sort of multi-benefit farming systems that improve nutrition, increase yields, but also provide much more resilient livelihoods for farmers and resilient ecosystems. We must look at minimizing degradation of land and rehabilitating degraded environments. We also must empower the marginalized food producers, particularly women, to produce a range of crops to strengthen land and water rights and increase access to markets and finance. In ensuring some of the subsidies for things such as water, you know, don't encourage our farmers to continue to deplete water supplies or destroy their native ecosystems. And of course, as policymakers around the world will look to incentivize how we get more intense agriculture, at the same time we must have a balance where we strengthen the governance for land and the governance aspects around land holdings for forests, wetlands and grasslands. So you can see we have a challenge. And without a global commitment to the meaningful reduction of greenhouse gas from all sectors, including agriculture, we simply won't be able to adapt the agriculture enough to meet our future food needs. I'd now like to hand over to my colleague, Professor Judy Wahungu, to say a bit more about some of the other recommendations.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. Our next speaker is Professor Judy Wahungu. Please go ahead, Professor.
Thank you very much. I'd like to build on what my colleagues have already mentioned by turning my attention to the Commission's recommendation to integrate food security and sustainable agriculture into global and national policies. You see, food insecurity, climate change, competition for energy, water, degradation of land and biodiversity are connected in complex ways and demand an integrated management approach. This commission emphasizes that efforts to alleviate the worst effects of climate change cannot succeed without simultaneously addressing the crises in global agriculture and the food system. But agriculture and food security tend to fall between the cracks of global policy making. Policymakers and practitioners must therefore navigate trade-offs among agricultural intensification, nutritional security, and environmental consequences. This is not easy and will require Herculean efforts. Existing and future investments in information and knowledge must be structured to identify limits, inform trade-offs, and deliver practical guidance for a sustainable future, and not simply to maximize single components of the food system. Therefore, the Commission is pointing to four major opportunities to address these critical issues. First, to establish a work program on mitigation and adaptation in agriculture in accordance with the principles and provisions of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change based on Article 2 as a first step to inclusion of agriculture in the mainstream of international climate change policy. Second, to make sustainable, climate-friendly agriculture central to green growth and the RioPlus20 Earth Summit. Third, finance early action to drive change in agricultural production systems towards increasing resilience to weather variability and shocks, while contributing significantly to mitigating climate change. This, of course, includes supporting national climate risk assessments, developing mitigation and adaptation strategies, and also program implementation. Fourth, develop common platforms at global, regional, and national levels for coherent dialogue and policy action related to climate change, related to agriculture, crisis response, and food security at global, regional, and national levels. These include fostering country-level coalitions for food security and building resilience, particularly in countries most vulnerable to climate shocks. And finally, we need to make concurrent efforts to establish climate-resilient agricultural production systems, make efficient use of resources, lower agriculture's carbon footprint, develop low-waste supply chains, ensure adequate nutrition, and encourage healthy eating choices. All of these together will constitute a sustainable food system. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Wahungu. Now we'll take questions for the speakers, and the operator will explain how to queue up for questions and will announce your name and media outlet. Please direct your question to one of the speakers, if you could, and you will have a chance to ask one follow-up question before we need to take the next one. Also, please keep to the topic of this call. Operator, please go ahead.
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, it is star, then 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to allow questions to queue. Once again, it is star, then 1 to ask a question. And we'll take our first question from the site of Richard Ingram with AFP. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I have two questions, if I may. One is directed to Sir John, and the other one is to Dr. Clark. Sir John, you mentioned the question of the number of people who went into poverty as a result of the food price spike. I wondered if when you've addressed the question of of food and climate change and sustainable development, how much the question of upheaval, of social turbulence and political challenge derived from the question of higher food prices and hunger. The other question to Dr. Clark is, you spoke about intensifying agricultural production. I'd like to know to what extent genetically modified crops are part of it. Thank you very much.
Now on to the first question then. I think the I pointed out in my opening remarks the way in which the changes in the price of food had resulted in the on two occasions now in the last few years in significant numbers actually moving into genuine poverty, and those people are the people who are moving into poverty are primarily those who are at, right at the extremes of conditions. I'm getting a lot of feedback, so I'm not sure whether I'm coming through, but I'll continue nevertheless. So there is a real concern about poverty, and of course there are consequences at the level where food price increases cause instability in societies. It's not necessarily always the poorest of the poor who are actually affected or indeed are able to respond to it. The first thing to say is that quite clearly a response from the international community to these price spikes has got to be providing more money so that the international agencies are able to purchase food to continue aid programs. That's got to be sensible in the short term, and that's appropriate. The analysis that has been done by a number of reports also points to the fact that unless climate change is actually addressed, then the expected price increases that are actually going to be coming, and indeed have already happened, are going to be much more severe. The projections that have been made by a number of reports are very much that food prices are going to increase over the next few decades, and that's inexorable due to changes in demand, increases in population, driven by increases in population, prosperity, and arguably problems to do with supply. In terms of, for example, if we are unable to address the waste conditions and waste continues, there's going to be a problem. If we are unable to actually address the issue of climate change and get agricultural strategies that can adapt to agriculture so that production is not undermined, then we're going to get even greater price increases. And a number of studies have pointed to that. So it is a real concern. Thank you.
And our next question comes from the site of Tiffany Stecker with Climate Wire. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. For my first question.
I'm sorry, operator. We had a second question that was asked of Dr. Clark from the AFP journalist.
Certainly. My apologies, Ms. Stecker. We'll be back with you in just one moment.
No problem.
Thank you very much. It's Dr. Clark online. Can you hear me?
Yes,
Dr. Clark. We can hear you.
Thank you. Just the question that was asked. The Commission really didn't set out to pick winners with regard to specific approaches to agriculture. What we set out to do, rather, was understand the barriers to sustainable agriculture. We looked at the major factors that could support agriculture that would deliver productivity. We looked at, you know, the livelihoods. How do you enhance resilience while minimizing greenhouse gas emissions and also unsustainable use? So in the face of the tremendous challenges that we've outlined, we really came to the conclusion that you need diverse responses depending on the context, and you even need niches. So this is all the way from organic right through to genetically modified.
Okay, great. Operator, the next question, please. Thank you.
Certainly. And we'll go back to the side of Tiffany Stecker with Climate Wire. Your line is now open.
Thank you very much for taking my call. My question, could you talk a little bit more about the Fast Start financing? How much do you should be given of that finance to agriculture and food security? And given the nature of the type of finance, what sort of leverage would it fund? My second question is, and a conference like the one that's going
Tiffany, I'm sorry. It's a little hard to hear your question.
Oh.
Maybe speak more into the handset.
Okay, can you hear me better?
Yes, we can hear you better.
Okay, great. So my first question is, can you please talk a little bit more about the Fast Start financing and what kind of agricultural projects are appropriate for that type of financing? How much would you suggest to the leaders at Durban in terms of that sort of financing? My second is, at a conference like the COP17, the question is not so much what needs to be funded and to pay for it. So my second question is, who should pay for this? These sort of agricultural investments, should it be divided, more or less equally between developed and developing countries, or private versus public funding?
Okay, Sir John, if you wanted to go ahead with that, and then we may have another commissioner also chime in on this as well. And then Tiffany, please mute your line while the answer is being given. Thank you.
I think that I'd probably suggest that the answer to the first question is directed to Adrian and then on to Bruce. So I think two of them would be able to provide an excellent answer to that. In answer to the second question, I think, again, Bruce would be helpful, but I would probably add a supplementary for myself at that stage. So over to you, Bruce, and then Adrian.
If you look at the what Africa, for example, Africa in a developing country faces in terms of climate change and the huge adaptation challenges for agriculture, through no fault of a smallholder farmer in Africa or any farmers in Africa, the problem of climate change has not been produced in Africa. I think that the funding for adaptation definitely has to come from the developed world. Hopefully it can be a mixture of public and private funding, but there's some tremendous challenges with, for example, carbon markets as a driver for the finance. Many challenges relate to smallholder production in terms of actually measuring carbon sequestration in soils and those sorts of things. I think it's feasible, but it's not going to be a solution in the short term.
Perhaps that's a start. Yeah, I'd probably add to that by saying that, I think the commission...
I'm sorry, who was just speaking?
It was John Bennington. I was going to just add what Bruce has said, if you're happy. I think the commission, in a sense, has a job to pose the problems. They're primarily a science advisory group, and I think that in the way in which funding mechanisms are developed, this is very much for the international donor community and the international community generally to actually look at these questions. I think agree completely with these are major problems that have got to be addressed. And what we're hoping that the report does is actually draw to the attention of the key policymakers, not just at the Conference of the Parties in Durban, but at subsequent discussions, for example, at Rio+20. These are urgent problems. They need substantial funding. I don't think it's, in a sense, we'll move out of the scale of terms of reference for a commission like ours to actually say who should pay.
Okay, Dr. Fernandez, did you want to add anything to this?
Sure.
Answer?
Just briefly to the question on Fast Start financing. Let me mention that Sir John already mentioned, we should perhaps separate the imperative of continue addressing the very short-term food crisis, which we have always experienced in the world food crisis, but it is quite clear that those crises are being exacerbated because of climate impacts already felt around the world. So, but let me separate those situations where we must find a way to quickly respond to current food crisis to more structural problems and challenges that are associated with making financing available. And what it's urgent in countries around the world, and we touched on this briefly, is to quickly develop the capacity to be able to analyze what are the likely impacts and the vulnerability assessment of climate in various countries in different sectors. And again, agricultural sector, agricultural production is certainly one of the most important. So it is urgent to develop this kind of analysis to try to understand in what ways climate is likely to impact agriculture, and therefore countries must prepare their adaptation and resilience building plans so that ongoing financial support internationally and future financial support is targeted in a cost-effective way. So we have a quick challenge of building capacity, assessments, understanding, and then for the increasing resources to flow to address these important issues.
Great. Thank you. Operator, let's move to the next question.
Certainly. And once again, as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, it is star, then one on your touch-tone phone. We'll now go to the side of Johanna Sharma with SciDev. Please go ahead.
Yes, my question is directed at Mrs. Warunguru. Is it Warunguru? I was interested in this idea that intensification of agriculture could also contribute to greenhouse gases, because quite a lot of the research into improving agriculture in terms of food security and hunger and poverty is directed at precisely closing that yield gap and intensification. Lei, wonder if you could say a little bit more about how this links up with climate change and adaptation. They seem to me two different things. So on what should be scientists be focusing right now?
Professor Wahungu, please go ahead.
Okay, I'm not sure I heard the question quite clearly.
Really?
But I think it was to do with intensification of agriculture.
We can repeat. We can have the question repeated. Let's
if
go ahead
just
and
shorten,
it.
If you could just shorten the question so that I can hear.
Okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
A lot of agricultural research is, at the moment is in response to food security and is geared towards yield, closing the yield gap and intensification. I'd like to hear more about how this is different from agriculture adapting to climate change, because, of course, intensification leads to more greenhouse gases. So there seems to be a contradiction in agricultural research at the moment. And I wondered if you could comment on that and where are we going with agricultural research?
Professor Wahungu. Okay.
Yes. Okay. I think I heard her clearly now. I don't see a contradiction. I think what the Commission has recommended and what the Commission has seen is that there are inefficiencies across the spectrum from the fork to the farm. And so what we are trying to address is, yes, you can increase yield, but you can also increase yield by using a variety of methods, including using less fertilizer, you know, integrated cropping. There are also organic methods. And so what we are recommending is that we reduce the inefficiencies. So I don't see a contradiction between increasing yields and then what we are recommending is we use less fertilizer, making the production system more efficient.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, great. Operator, the next question, please.
And our next question comes from the side of Natasha Gilbert with Nature Magazine. You may go ahead.
Oh, hi, yes, thanks very much. It was interesting that you just mentioned that one of the recommendations was to use less fertilizer because, of course, in Africa, there's very little fertilizer used at all, and that could also be regarded as an inefficiency because that's a main reason why the production is so low. So I was wondering what recommendations you could make to improve that inequality in fertilizer use and whether subsidies would be one solution to that. I mean, the report does suggest that some targeted subsidies might be useful, and would fertilizers be one of those areas? That's to whoever who wants to answer the question.
Okay, Sir John, would you like to direct the question, answer, and then direct, please?
I think I'd probably direct it to Megan Clark, but I just had, before I pass to Megan, I think there's no one-size-fits-all in terms of, for example, fertilizer. There are some groups of farmers, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, who just don't have enough. That's fair enough, and we need to be thinking about how we address that. At the same time, what we don't want to do, but there are other farmers in parts of Asia where actually they probably overuse fertilizer, even down to the potential of decreasing yields. So the issue is that there's no general answer in terms of fertilizer use. What is also fairly clear is that smarter ways of using fertilizer, for example, focusing on fertilizer that is actually applied to the plant rather than across a large area of land, is actually very efficient and actually can do two things and has a win-win of more efficient use of fertilizer, which is an expensive commodity, and expensive not just in money terms but also in terms of its contribution to greenhouse gases, but also that could actually have the potential to increase productivity. This is why we think that some of the work in terms of research going into agricultural practice could actually deliver a lot of benefits this way. But there is no doubt, as you indicate in your question, there are some areas of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, but also parts of Asia, where actually you do need more fertilizer to become available.
And Megan Clark here, just to add to those comments, absolutely. Whilst we know in sub-Saharan Africa that there's low levels, we also know that being very precise, ultra-precise, about very small doses of fertilizer, we've seen, particularly at the base of the plants, we've in a way seen that precision in other areas. We've seen it very precise delivery of fertilizer and water, for example, in vineyards. And so applying that same knowledge we know can improve. We also know that we can improve the root systems of plants to be much more efficient in the way they take up nitrogen from the soil. And that's very exciting research, because now you're really just getting a lot more capacity of the plant itself to use what is currently available. We also know, not so much on the fertilizer side, but by increasing the carbon in the soil, which is a form of storing the carbon in terms of biochar or soil char, we can increase the microbial components in the soil, and that has multiple benefits for the plant. And I would add that same precision, not just in fertilizer, but precision with water, something that obviously we're seeing in countries, such as my own, where water is such a precious and in some places expensive resource, using everything that you have available. Previous water usage on the land, satellite information on the moisture levels, climate information on evaporation rates, adding all of that up together, we've been able to have up to some 20% improvement in water usage just by adding that precision to the farmers, which is significant. So we know there are things that we can do to address this issue.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. I think that we have ended our question and answer session. Thanks to everyone for attending this audio briefing. And here is the telephone number to call in case you have follow-up questions and interview requests. Please call Preeti Singh at the U.S. country code 1-301-280-5722. Want to remind everyone again that the online press kit is available at http://ccaf.cgiar.org/commission/press-room. A digital audio recording of this briefing will be available later today. Thanks to everyone for participating in this call, and the news briefing is now complete.